basically headed into a committee hearing, I think, and which is why we needed to kind of push things around. This is, is the committee hearing about House Bill 485?
Yeah, it's House Bill 485, which is the attempt to undo what the Utah GOP State Central Committee did in their special meeting last week. Today is the final day of committee hearings up here on the Hill. So anything that needs to have at least one hearing, it has to happen today. So that's what's happening here. Basically, what this bill says is, trying to move around a couple of people here as we're getting into the bill, into the room. Basically, what the bill says is that the state would basically ignore what the Central Committee did. They're trying to kick off candidates from the ballot who take the signature gathering round in Congressional District 1 and 2. And this bill basically says, nope, it doesn't matter, it doesn't count, it never happened. And they're basically bracing for a bunch of lawsuits to come out of this.
So they really don't like this other opportunity for people to get onto the ballot, and which is why we're doing this.
Well, that's what these 51 members of the Utah Republican Party Central Committee are doing. They're basically asserting what they say is their right to determine how their candidates get on the ballot. Now, the problem is the parties don't control the ballot. The state controls the ballot. The party says they can control who their nominees are, but it's not the party's ballot. So that's basically what the middle, what this fight is about. But the problem is what they did with this rule change, kicking off candidates in the first and second congressional district only, which violates the separation of powers statute, or excuse me, the equal protection clause in the Constitution. It also violates state law. So what that would do is it would eliminate the caucus and convention system as a way for Republican candidates to get on the ballot and leave only signature gathering candidates because of the way state law is written. So basically it's an attempt to force a lawsuit so that the state party or these hardliners in the state party can try and get another bite at the apple and repeal SB 54, which was enacted in 2014 as a way to head off the Count My Vote ballot initiative. It's really complicated, and whatever happens today with this bill in committee, it'll get through both houses. I'm not sure in what form it's going to, but it won't be the end of it. There will be a lot of lawsuits coming out of this. Because at the very least, other political parties, the Democrats can sue and try to force Republican candidates to gather signatures. There are a lot of Republicans who have not even filed to do that because they were planning on using the caucus and convention system. And at probably the most draconian thing a judge could do is kick all Republicans off the ballot and force them to run as independents, which would be devastating to the party.
Right. And a poll, I think, that Utah Policy did show that Utahns do support Senate Bill 54, which does allow that second way through signature collection to get on the ballot.
Yeah, we asked about the Keep My Voice initiative, which is a ballot initiative that would repeal Senate Bill 54 and go back to caucus convention system as the only way for candidates to get on the ballot. And we found that 75% of Utahns support the current dual-track system, which allows a candidate to either gather signatures or to use the caucus convention system. Only 17% support this effort to roll back SB 54.
Legislative leaders, meanwhile, working behind the scenes with our schools now to come up with more funding for schools. What's in the works here, or do you know?
What we've heard, and as a little bit of background, our schools now is pushing a ballot initiative, which would raise income and sales taxes by a little less than half of a percent gradually, which would end up with about $700 million annually more for Utah's public schools. There are some on the Our Schools Now board who feel that the legislature has heard their message, so now they're trying to negotiate because, you know, if you were to look at it, a ballot initiative is sort of a blunt instrument. It can do one thing. Lawmakers can do things that are much more targeted through the legislative process. So that's what they're trying to talk about. We've heard maybe a deal to boost school funding, $300 million every year for the next 3 years. We've heard of a possible way to get transportation funding out of the general fund, and that's where a lot of this underfunding of Utah schools is coming from. This transportation funding is subsidized out of the general fund to the tune of around $600 million a year. You get transportation funding out of that source, and there's a lot more money for schools right there. The problem is, in order to do that, you'll have to raise taxes, establish toll roads, do something so that transportation pays for itself. Because right now our gas taxes, which is essentially a user fee for our roads, does not cover what it needs to. So lawmakers will have to come up with some very clever and innovative ways to provide more money for transportation and for schools if this is going to go through.
All right. Representative Tim Quinn's elimination of the food sales tax, it got through the House, but we're hearing it may be an uphill battle getting it through the Senate.
Yeah, the Senate doesn't like this idea. They're trying to find other ways to increase revenues. Now, and the food tax is a very regressive tax because it hits people at the lower end of the income scale much harder than it does the people at the upper end. But they don't like the raising of the sales tax across the board to make up for the lost revenue. There are a lot of other things that the Senate wants to use to or at least raise the sales tax for. One of them is going to be to fund transportation projects. There's Senator Wayne Harper's bill, which sort of reforms the UTA, changes the governing status, and it increases sales tax by 0.15%. The reason he had to do the sales tax increase is because they were waiting on the tax reform bill, which we haven't seen yet, which may be a tax cut for corporations and for individuals. We haven't seen that yet, but whatever his funding mechanism was going to be was closely tied to that. We haven't seen it yet, so he had to switch to a sales tax increase. So I think that Senate leaders are a little more wary about where they're going to raise the sales tax, and I just don't think that doing it to offset the losses from the food tax is going to happen.
Another bill that Park City is watching closely is Senator David Buxton's bill, SB 192, that would undo bans on single-use plastic bags and other containers. It passed the Senate last week. After a second vote, it's headed to the House, and basically this would nullify Park City's ban on plastic bag in large retail stores. Can you tell us what's happening here?
Yeah, I would expect that it goes through. There's lawmakers up here, they have sort of a libertarian streak to them, the Republican majority. So they don't like the idea of telling stores and consumers what they can and cannot do when it comes to something like this. So basically what happened is there was a bill that was going to ban the sale of plastic bags. That bill got changed. That bill fell, and then they turned around and passed the bill that would prohibit cities from enacting their own ban on plastic bags. So I'm not quite sure where that one's going to be. I'm trying to get a sense of that one as we head into the final days. Really, there's a lot of stuff that still needs to be done up here. So that one will probably go through in the last couple of days, because here's the schedule that we're looking at. Lawmakers still have to set the budget. They've got an Executive Appropriations Committee meeting today at 12:30, where they'll probably go over some of the final budget details, and we'll start to get an idea of what that's going to look like. The biggest sticking point I'm hearing is buildings, what buildings they're going to fund, what buildings they're not going to fund. Today is the last day for committee hearings, so you'll have a lot of hearings this morning to get these final bills out, because all bills pretty much have to have at least one hearing in committee. And obviously they can suspend the rules and bring bills back if they want to. Tomorrow, Tuesday, is the last day a bill that originates in either the House or Senate can pass out of that body. So if a House bill does not pass out of the House by tomorrow, it's pretty much done. Same thing for the Senate. And in the last 2 days, they're going to be negotiating over the final spending items, and they're going to be trying to get as many bills through as possible. One thing that is really concerning to a lot of people up here is we have not seen the priority funding list for bills. We don't know what initiatives the House or the Senate are going to try and fund as they work through their final negotiations. The House has been holding off on that, which is extremely out of the ordinary. So we'll have to see how that all shakes out. But it is going to be pedal to the metal the rest of the way here.
I know you need to walk into that committee hearing, but real quick, House Bill 483, this is Representative Steve Handy's bill, to that would allow police to get a court order to take away guns from, quote, an extremely dangerous person. And I guess, you know, the first thing that comes to mind is good luck defining that, huh?
Well, he does have some definitions in the bill. I don't have it in front of me, so I can't speak exactly to it. But this is what they call a red flag bill. There are five states already that have these kinds of bills. I know that House Speaker Greg Hughes is in favor of it. The Senate, a little bit more tepid about this idea. So I expect that it will finally pass, but I'm not sure in what form. But this is not a new idea. This has happened before in at least five other states, and it's one of these ideas for gun control that's starting to really gain steam around the country. And Handy was actually working on this issue prior to the shooting down in Florida, but he decided to get the bill drafters to get this thing done and out towards the end. I don't think that he was going to move forward with it in this session until the mass shooting happened down in Florida. But it's an interesting idea. I think lawmakers want to do something, and this is probably something that they'll be able to get done.
Okay. Hey, Brian, thanks for your time. We'll check back with you next week and see how. And with a look in the backcountry on the phone with us from the Utah Avalanche Forecast Center, Greg Gagne. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. Beautiful morning. Some snowfall overnight. From the Cottonwoods to the Park City Mountains, picked up another 2 to 5 inches. Storm totals since Saturday night are 30 inches in Little Cottonwood Canyon. This storm really did favor Little Cottonwood Canyon. 12 to 16 inches in Big Cottonwood Canyon, about 8 to 16 inches along the Park City Ridgeline and Park City Mountains. Activity yesterday primarily involved loose snow or small soft slab avalanching. These slides are breaking out within the storm snow down about a foot. Although the storm snow avalanches weren't propagating very widely, they were running far distances and training large amounts of snow. Late in the afternoon, too, people were noticing some sensitive wind drifts as the wind speeds began to pick up. One avalanche that did catch everyone's attention was from control work in the Park City Mountains, where explosives released a persistent slab avalanche that was 150 feet wide and a 10-foot crown. That's a very large avalanche. Ran on a layer of facets that formed early in February.
Joining me now in the studio with kind of recap of the two-day retreat, I have Park City Mayor Andy Bierman along with Council Member Becca Gerber. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Andy, do you feel like you met the task of kind of deciding, you know, who we are?
Well, I think it was an open discussion. It's probably leading into next year's community retreat where we're going to reevaluate who we are and what we want to be next. But I think it was a great discussion. There's a lot's changed in the last decade in Park City in terms of following the Olympics. I think we really were put on the map, and that's had a lot of impacts on the town. And it's brought a lot of stability. It's brought a lot of people, but it's also impacted who we are. And it's getting right with that and deciding what are the things we can let go and what are the things that we really want to hold on to tight and protect. So I think that was the start of the discussion, and it primed the pump for the rest of the retreat.
Yeah. And Becca, what was your takeaway then from the 2 days?
You know, I think it was a great opportunity for us to get together and talk about where we really want to focus our energies. I think, you know, as to who we are as a community, you're going to hear different things depending on who you talk to. But there are a lot of things that we do on a day-to-day basis just to keep the city running. But then we have these opportunities to have conversations about really what we want to do proactively and where we want to go. And so this weekend was all about that. Or how do we want to focus our energies, and where are we going to spend our time and energy really trying to make a difference in our community as opposed to just, you know, keeping the lights on and making sure the water is pumping?
Yeah. So when we think about what's going to happen then over the next years, things change just a little bit, but by adding social equity as a critical priority?
Yes. I think there's been a lot of things that have kind of been leading up to this. We've felt it in our community for years and years. We know that we have a strong immigrant population, and we want to make sure that, you know, there's a lot of social inequity in our town. There are definitely the haves and the have-nots, and there's the workforce and, you know, kind of the retired community. And we know that there's a problem. We've seen the loss of community, the loss of people in our neighborhoods, the loss of people. You know, we experience workforce shortages, and so now we're kind of getting to a point where We know that we need to take some drastic steps, and we're not quite sure what they are yet. But by making social equity a critical priority, it allows us to dedicate staff time and some of our energy to actually going out into the community and trying to figure out where those gaps are and how we can help and really try to make sure that we are that complete community that we strive to be.
Yeah. So when you talk about drastic steps, I mean, what are you talking about?
You know, that's the thing, is that it's hard whenever we've had a critical priority in the past. You know, we've had some ideas as to maybe what to do, but we've really looked to the community and to the staff to help us figure out where we want to go. For affordable housing, you know, they made it a critical priority. They were able to dedicate funding towards it, and we've been able to come up with a housing pipeline that we're working on, and we have projects lined up now. The same happened with transportation. We brought in some new staff. We have some big projects going on with transportation and parking, brought in new buses. And so it really does allow us to kind of focus our energy and start providing some additional resources towards looking at what we need to be doing. And it's hard because, you know, we've heard it that we don't have a lot of diversity on our council, and we don't have a lot of diversity in our commissions and boards. So this is an opportunity for us to really reach out to the community and hear what they, you know, what our diverse populations need, and have them help lead the discussion.
Yeah. So, Andy, when you talk about focusing energies, I mean, and social equity, what does this mean in terms of what we might see over the next year?
Well, we're still sorting some of that out. I'm not sure this one is as defined as our past critical priority. So, in 2 weeks, I believe this is coming back to council in a work session, and we do have a value statement we're working off of, but I think the general feel is that inequities are building both in Park City and society in general. And we started this concept 2 years ago of having a complete community, a community people live in, and a community where people feel welcome and valued. And that's something that we need to work on. And I think what you'll see immediately is more leadership with a Park City Municipal Organization. We are going to look at how every action we do impacts social equity. And we're also going to start working directly. Actually, we already have started working with a number of the nonprofits in town to do a gaps analysis, figure out what are the areas where we could better help our underserved population. Do we need a hub? Has been a big topic of discussion, and we're going to continue to consider that. And we're going to explore these partnerships. But I think this is one of those priorities that's going to evolve over time. Council wanted to send a statement that this is important to us and we want to take immediate action. What that action looks like is still something we're working on defining.
Yeah. And when you kind of look at your, I don't know, what do you call this? Your graphic kind of timeline?
The graphic recorder we had come to the retreat.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, when you talk about providing incentives to landlords to keep long-term rentals, this would deal with kind of your affordable housing critical priority, working with developers, stepping up where the private sector can't. At what point do we talk about the city's role and then actually some kind of social engineering going on here? Is that the council's role?
You know, we've talked about what our role is, and Tim can give the free market spiel much better than I can, but we know that we are losing some things from our community, and a big part of what we're losing is anyone who can't afford a $2.2 million house now. So if you're talking about social engineering as to we are trying to create opportunities for people who might not be able to live in town, we're trying to create opportunities for them to stay in town. Sure, if that's what you mean by that. But really what we're trying to create are options. Right now there are no options. We are losing rentals, and there are a variety of factors playing into that in addition to the rising property prices, the rise of the Airbnb. And, you know, it's really interesting when we look at, you know, we're talking about doing another visioning session in 2020. When we look at what happened in 2009, we were a completely different community in a lot of ways. We were just coming off a recession. Airbnbs and Uber and Lyft didn't really exist yet. So the way that we communicate, the way we live, and our housing has been greatly disrupted in our community. And we're just trying to make sure that we hold on to people and hold on to a community.
So
can I add to that? There was a pretty strong discussion on whether government's role is leadership or ownership in this. And we believe as a group that this needs to be owned by the community. The desire to focus on social equity has come up through the community. It's something we've all heard as council members. And we don't feel like this is the kind of thing that can be imposed on the community by government and be effective. So we plan to work a lot with our local nonprofits. Park City can step in is, again, internally showing leadership through our practices at the city, and then also as a resource helping our nonprofits, whether that's funding, whether that's adding staffing to things, or even just using our platform to communicate what we're trying to accomplish as in social equity. But all in all, I think we all agreed strongly that this needs to be a community effort, not just a governmental effort. And we are really in a support role.
Okay. And then I see also a little note here, you know, keeping people from getting in their cars. Again, if that's coming from the community, we still see people getting in their cars. I mean, I think I go back to that kind of that social engineering aspect here. You know, we're creating the Arts and Culture District. I mean, that was a city idea. So talk a little bit more about where the ideas are coming from the community that are bubbling up to you. I mean, are you saying that that's what people are saying?
Well, yeah. I mean, traffic is probably the thing I hear the most complaints about in town. And in terms of social engineering, I think what the city's trying to do is provide a infrastructure that people don't need cars, that it's a car optional town. And we're doing that through our transit system, through the electric bikes, through better trails and walkability, through better communications, encouraging people to get in their vehicles. And then there are some specific areas where things like paid parking, that is a little bit more on the social engineering side, where we are putting disincentives in place to encourage people to try the transit and find it to be effective. But I think our main focus is really creating an infrastructure that allows people or encourages people not to use their cars and gives them plenty of options.
Well, and we have a set of core values that you know, that we kind of fall back on. And I believe that everything that we're doing really falls back into those core values: sense of community, natural setting, small town feeling, and historic preservation. So when we talk about one of the things that really makes Park City not feel like a small town, getting stuck in traffic for hours and not being able to get where you're going and get around town and access what you need to access on a day-to-day basis, that really detracts from our sense of small town. So I think we're really taking all of our critical priorities kind of go back to those values. You know, our energy goal goes back to our natural setting, and our housing goal goes back to our sense of community. So I think that really our critical priorities are strong reflections of the values that we've said that we hold as a community.
So did you have more discussion then with regard to transportation and energy and housing?
We didn't spend a ton of time on those specifically. We did spend some time reaffirming that we agree those need to be critical priorities. Even though we feel like we've made some progress and we're working on both funding and critical paths for each one of those, there's a lot of work to be done. And we feel like they will probably remain critical for years into the future.
And you did get a brief overview on this community visioning that you were talking about, Becca. That's going to happen in 2020. We're going to be planning, and before then, is that?
We actually didn't have time for that. We had one of our discussions run over, so that's going to come up in a work session probably in late March or early April.
All right. And then another discussion was the growth and the roles of the mayor and city council. I think you led this discussion, Andy. What happened there?
It's a tricky discussion because the in a perfect world, the council and mayor role would be available to anybody, that it would be accessible and they could step in. The reality is the time required by the role and the erratic schedule and the small amount of compensation in return for that doesn't make it available to people that have young families or full-time jobs or other commitments. So we were talking about, are there ways we can make it more available to a broader range of our residents? And this is something we had a Blue Ribbon Commission 4 years ago take a look at. And I think we had a great discussion. I don't think we came up with any solutions per se. We did. We've tried to cut down on our packets this year. I implemented a request that no staff reports longer than 3 pages, and we're still working on that. But our packets have come down considerably. Most of them are in that 150 to 200 page range, as opposed to 400, which they were creeping up to. We talked about trying to be more vigilant in our meeting times to accommodate limited schedules. And then we talked about reducing some of our liaison assignments, which we actually went on to continue that discussion. And we're going to back off on some of our liaison requirements. But at the end of the day, I think the upshot is council didn't feel like we wanted to reduce the scope of the job. There are a lot of things that need to be done, and the only way we could really get to that would be to reduce what's on our agenda, try to accomplish less, or delegate a lot more authority to staff. And I don't think either of those were options we wanted to pursue right now.
Yeah, but I guess is that the city council's decision to make? I mean, you did make it with your new selection. I mean, if I say as a full-time, you know, working person, you know, with a family, that I can also take on the council job, isn't that my decision and not the council's?
You know, that's a tough one, Leslie, because the question is, do we... I view public service as a certain degree of sacrifice. There is something that you put off in your life to make it a priority. And I consider right now it an honor to be chosen for this role. And it's something that I've made a top priority in my own life. And I've put aside a lot of other opportunities. I think it's difficult to make the job dumb it down to the point where it's accessible to anybody. I think people need to make choices whether they want to step in. What we can do is we've increased the compensation. That happened a couple of years ago. We've tried to rein in the role. We certainly make exceptions. Everybody on council has different availability, and we have made exceptions over the year for that, or we've accommodated that as council. Some of us that have more time will step up and take other things and allow for people that have work or family obligations. And it's worked out pretty well. I think we're going to put that to test soon with Becca here.
Yeah. And I will say to your point, yes, if you say you work a full-time job and you have all these obligations, but you know when city council meetings are and you make the effort and run for council and get elected, then you absolutely should be on council, I think, or have an opportunity to be on council. It is difficult. You know, some of the harder things I think with council right now are just that there is so much that we've taken on over the past few years. And I kind of set out to go to council meetings for about a year before I ran, and I was there every meeting. And it did feel like it does feel like the pace has picked up since I was going to those council meetings. I know there was still a lot going on, but you know, a big topic of discussion for a long time was like toters and the garbage cans. And now we've taken on all these big projects, and it does take a lot of time. And I don't know if there's a natural ebb and flow to kind of these meetings and the way things go in town. I haven't been on council long enough to really get a good feel for that. There is a lot going on in town right now, and it's hard because you do want to be able to be involved in everything that's going on. And for me, it is going to be more difficult. I do have a full-time job. I am having a baby in the next couple of weeks, and that's going to be a big life change for me. But there are people in much worse circumstances and harder circumstances than I am. And for me, it's not an option whether or not I work. And it's not an option whether or not I'm involved in my community for me. I personally feel very passionately about trying to make it here. And I want to be a voice for those that are in kind of the same situation that I am and stay involved. So I'm going to make it work. And it might be hard and it's going to be difficult. But those are some of the sacrifices I feel like sometimes you have to make.
And I'd like to point out, too, there are a lot of ways you can serve your community in Park City. We have many boards and commissions which have quite a bit of influence on what happens at the city, as well as there's numerous nonprofits as well as involvement in the county. And I think every individual can pick a way to serve their community, whether it's serving in one of these organizations or volunteering, and according to what their availability is. So a council isn't the only way you can help your community.
Well, I understand that, but it sounds like you're saying, though, that, yeah, you can't do all of this and also be on the council because it is a very busy job.
I'm not saying that, but I am saying it's difficult. It's challenging for all of us. It's a large time commitment, and it's an erratic time commitment. You might only have 3 meetings in a day, 3 hours of meetings, but one might be at 9 o'clock, the next at 1, and the next one at 6. So that's very difficult to fit in a schedule, but people make it happen. Over the years, it's continued to happen, and we're going to do our best to rein in the job so it doesn't grow any further.
So do you see yourself as a one-term council person, Becca?
You know, it's so hard to know right now. I all the projects that we're working on take a long time to get done. And so I'd like to stay involved as long as I can, but it's hard to predict the future, and life is going to happen. And it might happen to me, and it's going to happen to other people in different ways. So it's really hard to predict the future in any way, shape, or form at this point in time. But I've really enjoyed my role, and I enjoy getting to participate, and I still have almost 2 years left, so don't look for me to back down anytime soon.
Real quick, I also want to talk a little about your own version of Shark Tank. This happened on Thursday. You picked what two projects that you're going to fund? Is that how it works? Or
well, we narrowed it down to five, actually, so five or six. And I'm not sure all of them are going to get immediate funding. We're going to have to look at it. But I think the first three or three and a half we have enough funding for. But the idea of this was it's a social equity innovation challenge. And we floated this out a few years ago. We did an innovation challenge at our retreat with a little bit of a funding surplus we had. We went to all the departments and said, hey, we'd like you to follow a Shark Tank format and come to us with some unconventional ideas on how you can do things to better efficiency at the city or to help our community. And we got some fantastic ideas that came out of that. We decided this year, since the theme of the retreat was social equity, to do the same thing with social equity. We had 12 submittals. Every one of them was really solid. And we ended up selecting several of them. And two of them were related to the library. One of them was to increase the Spanish materials. Another one was to bring a great speaker to town by the name of Erica Sanchez. And then we also had one in the sustainability department to go in and retrofit a lot of our affordable housing with high efficiency bulbs and weatherization. And next one was a idea to work with our Pando Labs and our business incubators, working with some of our underserved population.
So you'll have to come back later then and decide what can be funded?
Yeah, council will decide in the budget process. Probably we will decide how to fund those. I think the first few we'll probably be able to fund before then. But we have some other ones in there we might decide to fund as well.
All right. Anything else you wanted to add?
I think it was a great discussion, and we had a lot of our community show up and provide some great input onto many of our discussions. So thank you to everyone in the community who took the time to show up, and also to everyone who came and participated in activities with us over the weekend or the week.
Yeah. And then, Andy, you said that you're going to have these kind of written out drawings that were done of the retreat hanging up in the...
Yeah, we did something a little bit different this time. In addition to recording it, we had what's called a graphic recorder. It's somebody that came and did murals, essentially, encompassing our conversations. And we're going to have those hanging up in the hallways of City Hall starting soon. I'm not sure we need to get them put up on posters, but those are going to go up. So I encourage people to come by and see them, and we'll probably bring those to our next few forums as well.
Okay. Hey, Andy and Becca, thanks for your time.
Thank you, Leslie.
You. Joining me now in the studio, U.S. Ski and Snowboard spokesman Tom Kelly. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. Winter, it's here again.
Yeah, just a late start, but it's here. Let's see, Rev Tour happening in Park City.
Yeah, we had a great event last week, the Toyota Rev Tour, which is kind of the proving grounds for a lot of the young athletes that you'll see in Beijing in 2022 and wherever else we are in 2026. And also a test event for the World Championships coming next year, February 1st to 10th. And the big thing that we wanted to test and have the International Ski Federation here for was the new slopestyle course. And folks may remember that the slopestyle course at Park City was on King's Crown. That was converted into a recreational skiing run. And I have to say, it's one of my favorite runs on the mountain. And the new course on Three Kings worked out really well. First time that we've tried it, and we were able to test it with this development program, and the FIS was pretty happy with it. A few tweaks will be made before next year, but it was really good to get that in, and our hats off to everyone at Park City Mountain for having the innovation and the drive to come up with that course, which will give us a finish area immediately adjacent to what will be a 22-foot half pipe next year. So a really nice layout for us. We're still in the finalization of tweaking some of the venues for this event next year. This will be an extraordinary event. It will encompass the resorts of Solitude over in Big Cottonwood Canyon, as well as Park City Mountain and Deer Valley, and still a few more announcements to be made on final sites for some of the events, but should be a great festival February 1st to 10th next year here in Park City.
How big was the half pipe in South Korea?
22 foot is the standard for a competitive half pipe. The one that's there at Park City this year is a little bit smaller given the snow conditions we had early on. It's an 18 foot pipe, which was what was used at the start of the Olympics for snowboarding back in 1998. But it'll be a 22 foot pipe, same as we had in Pyeongchang.
Okay. Let's have a look at the Alpine team after the Olympics.
little bit of an off weekend. A lot of people taking a break, including Lindsey Vonn and Michaela Schifrin. You know, it's interesting with Michaela Schifrin. She has now a 561-point lead over Wendy Holdner with six events remaining. So if it's 100 points per event, she can clinch this thing next weekend in Ofterschwang, Germany. So she decided no reason to go to Crans-Montana. She just took the weekend off and trained in Europe. So we'll see next weekend, but pretty good chance that Michaela Schifrin's going to wrap up the overall World Cup title next weekend. On the men's side, good results from Tommy Ford and Ryan Cochran-Siegel in the giant slalom in Kranjska Gora. Tommy finishing ninth, Ryan 10th, both career best finishes for them. They're kind of the next generation coming up after Ted Ligety. Ted, unfortunately, going out in the first run at Kranjska Gora, but he'll be back for World Cup finals in 2 weeks. And next weekend, the men are up at Kvitfjell, Norway for a downhill and a Super G, and the women in Ofterschwang, Germany for a GS and a slalom.
So is Lindsay going to be able to make her goal of getting the World Cup wins, beating Stenmark?
You know, I think she is. And I feel a lot more confident than I did before this season. She's picked up, I think, 4 wins this year. So she's at 81 right now, and she really needs, you know, just 4 more to tie. So she's going to skip next weekend. There's no reason for her to go to a GS and a slalom. She'll be back for the World Cup finals in Åre, Sweden in 2 weeks. Good chance there for her to pick up another win or maybe 2, bring her a little bit closer. And I got to say, you know, I left the games with a really good feeling about where she is. I think mentally she honestly is really happy with where she is with her career, with how she did at Pyeongchang with the bronze medal, and her goals ahead of her. So the Olympics are in her rearview mirror right now, and her sight is that record of Ingemar Stenmark and also an opportunity to ski against the men. So a lot of interesting things on Lindsey Vonn. I think she really rejuvenated herself with her Olympic finish and with the fact she's won those 4 World Cups this year.
So any decision by FIS on whether or not she gets to race the men?
No, it'll come up again this May at our International Ski Federation meetings. It was pretty heavily talked about last fall. It's been kind of tabled right now. But I think with the fact that she's got that much closer to Stenmark, it kind of opens up the decision-making a little bit. If this did happen at Lake Louise, it would impact her competing in some World Cups, and I know that that's going to be a factor for her. So right now, it's kind of in the back of everyone's mind. Everyone wants to do this. They just need to figure out a methodology. So it'll come up this spring.
Okay. Freestyle, where are we at there?
Good weekend for the Moguls team. Keaton McCargo, who lives in Camas, picking up a third-place finish in Moguls on Saturday, and then Sunday, Tess Johnson, 17 years old, getting her first World Cup win. They were in Tazawako, Japan, a site that they started competing at last year. So they just made the short kind of hour and a half flight from Seoul over to Japan and the land of great powder snow. They have 2 more moguls events left, one coming up with a dual moguls event in Airola, Switzerland this weekend, and then another one the following weekend. Jalen Koff had been leading the World Cup. She dropped back a little bit this weekend, but still 2 events to get back on top.
Okay, and in free ski?
Big event in Silva Plana, which is in the Samaritz area, for folks who know that part of Switzerland, up at the ski area of Korvac. This is a really cool slopestyle course. It's way up towards the top of the mountain in Korvac, with just absolutely breathtaking views for the athletes. And kudos to Alex Hall of Salt Lake City and Park City, picking up his first World Cup win there in the slopestyle. A couple more events coming up for them to round out the season, but really nice to see Alex, who was an Olympian, a local Olympian, actually, pick up a win in Silva Plana.
Okay. And ski jumping, nothing from the women?
Really, not too much on the women's side. There was an event in Rosnov, Romania this weekend. The only woman who went to that was Nita England. She finished 38th and 39th, so really not much to report there. But we're all looking ahead to this weekend. The women get a chance again to ski in the big hill at Holmenkollen. So, you know, Sarah Hendrickson's eyes are going to get big this weekend to be able to jump there. And then they have one more event coming up in Oberstdorf, Germany later this month. On the men's side, though, a really good weekend for Kevin Bickner. He finished 20th in a World Cup in Lahti, Finland, as part of the Lahti Ski Games. This was his best World Cup finish ever outside of ski flying, and he's going to have another chance at ski flying coming up later this month. So I just like to put his name out there. He, along with Will Rhodes of Park City and Michael Glaster and young Casey Larson of the Norgi Ski Club, really starting to make some forward progress for men's ski jumping in the U.S.
Okay, and let's see, cross-country, where are we at there?
Well, Keegan Randall and Jesse Diggins took the weekend off. They actually went to New York City and did 3 days of media and other appearances. And it was really fascinating because it just allowed them to put the sport of cross-country skiing out there like it's never been talked about before. And we went into this with a real mission, and that is we want to bring a World Cup cross-country race to downtown Minneapolis in 2 years, in 2020. I mean, this is just such a hotbed of skiing. It's Jesse Diggins' hometown. And the women took that message to New York, and talking to media and talking to sponsors and donors, and it was really, really well received. So I think now this spring that we'll go into the International Ski Federation meetings with a plan. FIS has wanted to do this for some years. It's a little bit of an aggressive plan to get a World Cup in 2 years, but for all the cross-country fans out there, just know that it's right around the corner. We can see it happening right now.
So Minneapolis has then those trails already?
Minneapolis is a fantastic place to do this. There's an organization called the Lopet Foundation, which has developed an amazing track system on a golf course in Theodore Worth Park in downtown Minneapolis. If you know the city, it's just kind of west of downtown, southwest of downtown in the lakes area. So the courses exist there. There's a great infrastructure with the organizing committee. They have a history of putting on events. There's, you know, many million people in that area who love cross-country skiing. So we think this could be just a fantastic city event. If we did it, it most likely would be a sprint event. We would want it to be a sprint event and something that would showcase our team and showcase Jesse Diggins. So it's just expensive to do that. And now we've kind of lit the fire with the gold medal from Keegan and Jesse, and hopefully that will pull us through.
Okay, and a couple of other good finishes then from the gals.
Yeah, Lahti Ski Games, and it's kind of a good news, bad news weekend. Overall, a lot of illness and things, as you can expect after the Olympics, which took a lot of energy out of the team. But Sadie Bjornsson coming through with a 7th in the 10K Classic on Sunday at the Lahti Ski Games, and Sophie Caldwell 8th in the freestyle sprint. But the big news over the week, we had a new skier to the World Cup, Kevin Bolger, who folks might know. He was a member of that NCAA championship team for the Utes last year. Hails from Minocqua, Wisconsin, my home state, and now he skis out of Sun Valley. So this was his first World Cup, and especially on the men's side, you go into a first World Cup, and it's a sprint, and you've got to qualify in the top 30, and he qualifies 16th, and everybody's kind of looking, who is this guy? And then he gets into the quarterfinals, and you kind of figure, well, you know, he's hanging towards the back. There's not much chance he's going to move on to the semis, and all of a sudden, in the last 200 meters, he just put in some really good tactical moves and really had the sprint energy left and came around on the outside very much in Jesse Diggins fashion and moved himself up into fourth and got a lucky loser position to move on to the semifinals, ended up 11th on the day. So kudos to Kevin Bolger, a former Ute, for a great performance in Lahti.
Okay, anything else?
No, that'll do it. Just enjoy the snow out there, folks. Two more weeks of the World Cup season.
Okay, Tom Kelly from the U.S. Ski and Snowboard. Thanks.